Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we deem most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. An unusual number of guests up today, three. First, a couple of reports from the heartland of America. Abe Sauer in Wisconsin, talking about the state of the labor uprising there, and Abby Rappaport in Texas, talking about their governor, the slick, right-wing, curiously coiffed opportunist Rick Perry, who may run for president because budget-cutting Bible thumpers are so underrepresented in American politics. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from the economist John Bakia, who recently published a paper on just who it is who makes up the very rich. My first guest today is Abe Sauer. Abe, who was on this show in March, has been covering events in Wisconsin for the excellent website The All, AWL, ever since that state became a hotbed of confrontation between a government at war with its workers and the workers who want to fight back. In February, when Governor Scott Walker first proposed eliminating collective bargaining for state workers and making workers greatly increase their share in paying for health and retirement benefits, demonstrators essentially occupied the Capitol building for days in one of the most inspiring mass actions we've seen in this country in a long time. Alas, things haven't been going so swimmingly since. Walker got what he wanted, and the state Supreme Court upheld his bill. There was some hope in the workers' camp back in April when it looked like a challenger to Supreme Court Justice David Prosser would unseat him, but Prosser was reelected by the barest of margins, thereby providing Walker with the vote he needed. So what's been happening in Wisconsin since the Madison upsurge of February? Here's Abe Sauer to talk about that. Welcome, Abe. I want to talk about Wisconsin, but just before we get to that, you recently attended a convention of right-wing bloggers. Tell us what that was all about.
It's an annual conference that's been going on since 2008, hosted by Americans for Prosperity, which is a kind of conservative political action group. And it basically has two parts. It trains conservative people to use technology and online media, social media, to kind of become message multipliers for kind of the conservative message. And then it also has a lot of ideology. There are panels and special sessions on right-wing causes such as Obamacare, and big speakers for those. Virginia Attorney General Ken Curselli was there, and he's the one bringing a lawsuit against Obamacare. So it's kind of two parts. It's very far to the small government Tea Party side. It's not necessarily a conventional Republican conference, but it has very nuts and bolts training seminars like Twitter 101 and Facebook 101, where people who are ideological conservatives are shown how to use social media to get out there and get their message out and do things like just comment on newspaper articles. You know, go in there and comment on an article, contest the facts. You know, place doubt out there. It's kind of a online wetworks organization, but that's kind of what they're doing. And to be fair, the left does it too, with Netroots, another conference that was going on at the same time.
What's the age range of this thing?
It's pretty expansive. You know, it definitely skewed on the older side. I would say that the vast majority were, well over their mid 40s. Some were elderly, but there were some young activists there. It definitely brings in a lot of the blogger community, especially the well-known blogger community, like Rob Port. He runs the Say Anything blog out in North Dakota, and he was there. And if I had to guess at his age, I would say he's 32. So a lot of the leading kind of blogger voices are a little bit younger, but the age of the average attendee was pretty high. So like, you know, the Fox News age. The Fox News viewership age is skewed pretty high.
These are the people that need to be trained how to use Twitter. They're unlike those who emerge from the womb already knowing.
Well, I think that they are people who, you know, are motivated to, and this is something I found surprising and is, I think, worth attention. I mean, these people are motivated to pay $100 and travel to Minneapolis to gain knowledge and network on how to get their message out there. I mean, that's a very proactive thing for, you know, a quote-unquote stereotypical crank to be doing. I think that it shows that, for one thing, this whole idea that the Tea Party is dying is definitely off base. I mean, they definitely have a very strong group of support, even if it is becoming a little fractured.
And they're very eager to recruit young folks to their agenda, right?
Yeah, they definitely would like, I mean, every movement wants to have a more youthful core. And they had one of the breakout sessions there was run by teenagers and was focused on how to engage high schoolers and college students with the conservative message. I mean, the far right small government conservative message that you would expect to see at kind of the Tea Party meetings, either through Christian initiatives or economic policy.
All right, let's move on to Wisconsin, and where now that the initial upsurge from February has greatly receded from view, at least national view. What's that? What's it look like on the ground in Wisconsin now? It's not so much a national story as it was, but is it still a big Wisconsin story?
Well, yes, in Wisconsin, it is still a very big story. There are 9 recall elections that are coming up here in the next couple of months. Actually, more than that, if you count the primary elections. And that's for 9 members of a 33-member Senate. So a significant proportion of the state Senate has been recalled. And the power shift that could happen after this recall election could put the Senate back in control of Democrats, which would allow them basically to stop a lot of legislation. Right now, the Republicans control the House and the Senate and the governor's desk. So they can basically pass whatever they want. And the Democrats wrestling control of the Senate again, which would require them to pick up 3 of these 6 recalled Republican seats and defend their own 3 seats, would then put them in position to block a lot of legislation in the near future, with the idea in mind that Walker would be recalled after his 1 year in office requirement in November.
Of course, now, even if the Democrats were to regain control of the Senate, that doesn't mean they could reverse any of Walker's legislation, does it?
No. Unfortunately, I think that there may be some people who see this as a chance to do that, as there were a lot of people who saw the chance to gain control of the Supreme Court in the April election as a way to stop the budget bill that abolishes collective bargaining for state workers. That, you know, has passed. Even if they do get control of the Senate, they would not be able to pass anything by the governor, who would still veto anything that would restore collective bargaining for state workers. So other than a First Amendment ACLU, I believe, challenge to the budget bill, which is a really long shot, the collective bargaining has been pretty effectively killed in the state. So I just don't see a way that even after the recalls that they could reverse that right now.
I'm speaking with Abe Sauer, who's been covering Wisconsin for The All, among other things. I happened to be in Madison in February on some other business and got to see the initial days of the upsurge. But it was quite something to behold, the amazing crowds at the state Capitol building. What remains of that level of popular mobilization? I don't think you can't sustain that sort of thing forever, but does any of it remain?
Well, there's definitely still a strong spirit of that that movement. I think that, you know, the very recent Supreme Court decision upholding the passage of the budget bill was a real backbreaker, in the sense that it didn't leave a single issue to rally around anymore for people going to the Capitol. There didn't seem to be any more the immediacy of needing to stop a single bill or a single action by the legislature. You know, that energy right now for the people who are really dedicated has moved to the different districts of the recall election, and that is something you don't see necessarily, you know, so focused in a kind of in-your-face protest movement. They did last week when the legislature was in an extraordinary session, they did have an attempt to bring people to the Capitol again to have a giant show. There were several thousand people, but it wasn't the, you know, the tens of thousands that swamped Madison several months ago. And I think that because there weren't as many as there were before, it was seen widely within, you know, both the movement itself and for people opposed as kind of a loss of heart to continue to see this through. Now, whether or not that will be true in the recall elections in these individual districts is unclear, but definitely the idea of the massive protests has petered out in Madison, even if the spirit is still there for some people.
What are the prospects for the recall elections? Any sense of that?
Three of the Republicans, Alberta Dowling, Luther Olson, and Dan Kopanky, are definitely in some danger, with Dan Kopanky and La Crosse being probably at the top of that list. His seat looks pretty gone right now, which will turn over to a Democrat, Jennifer Schilling, who is a state representative from that area right now. The Alberta Dowling one could also change over, and the Olson one is close. The other Republicans seem fairly safe right now. The Democrats seem fairly safe right now as well. It's really those three that are the tightest. But because of the primary elections, which have been forced by the Republicans by running fake Democrats in those elections, there is some real chance that voter turnout will be a real problem. And that if voter turnout is not strong, the Republicans have a good chance of retaining all of their places. And if that happens, I would just say, if the Republicans defend all six of their recalled senators, it will be seen as an absolute approval of everything that they've done so far. And I wouldn't be surprised to see then Scott Walker and the legislature just push for everything they've ever wanted.
As if they hadn't done it already. But why are they running these phantom candidates in Democratic primaries?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. If you talk to the candidates themselves, they may say they're running as protest candidates to bring awareness to the fact that they don't believe that being able to recall elected officials is right. Definitely fits within the guidelines of Wisconsin election law. If you look at it from a more cynical, probably more accurate standpoint, they're running them to basically do two things. Delay the general election into August, which means more time to pass more legislation, but also to create more elections, which you have now you have elections happening on July 12th and then again on August 9th. It's a lot to ask of voters, you know, voters who already don't turn out in huge numbers in smaller elections to get energized enough to vote in both of those elections. There could definitely be some confusion on which one they're supposed to be voting in and everything else. And, you know, the hardcore people who always vote aren't going to be a problem. It's going to be picking up those extra ones who tip the scale at that you know, 48% level over to the majority. And you know, getting out the vote is going to be really important to do, but you're going to have to do it twice in a month, and that's a huge challenge. So part of what they've done here is create kind of mass confusion in a lot of these districts.
If you, as you say, the turnout is likely to be a problem, then that suggests that the level of passion in the broad public is really not as high as it might be among hardcore activists.
Well, amongst hardcore activists, the level of passion is always high, even if it's you know, to a degree that a lot of people find distasteful sometimes. It's usually, you know, that small 10% group that swings the election one way or the other, whether it's Walker or Prosser, the Supreme Court judge. I mean, these winning by these slight margins. It's people who are undecided or, you know, are very much moderates or even independents. I mean, those are the people that you're going to need to get out there and vote their positions. And getting them to go twice is, you know, not everybody is as invested in the political process as the people who, you know, were down at the Capitol for days and weeks at a time And finding those people and getting them to go vote is going to be a challenge. And it's going to be even harder making sure that they have IDs.
Oh, there's new identification requirements?
Well, part of the new identification requirements will be in effect for this upcoming election, but not the really full ones. That will be, I believe, in the next election cycle, that the full state ID to vote law will be in effect, which at that time will be one of, I believe it is the most strict voter ID law that's ever been passed in the United States.
And this is part of the Republican package?
Yeah, this was something that they pushed through about a month ago, and it basically only allows people with one of very limited amount of state IDs to vote in elections, which could be, once it's signed, could be open to, I believe, some challenges on constitutional grounds, given the fact that you have to pay to get any one of these IDs, which functions kind of like a poll tax, forcing somebody to spend $20 to get an ID to vote. That's basically a poll tax.
And then finally, what is Walker's overall popularity look like?
The last polling numbers I saw for him were like a 43% approval rating. It's been steadily going down, I believe, about 2 to 3% every 3 or 4 weeks. It's hard to say what those numbers mean exactly. He has a 43% approval rating, but 50% of people favor a recall for him. So the recall elections that are coming up will say a lot about how energized people are going to be in November to actually recall the governor. That's a long time to keep people really keep their blood up. And beyond that, if the economy continues to pick up, I think that people will be a lot less likely to see him as being in need of recall. There could be a situation where it's an economy stupid kind of thing that goes on with Walker. And if more people are in work and it looks like Wisconsin's turning around, he may be able to take the credit for that.
And finally, I think Wisconsin has a national reputation as a liberal state, but in fact, it's actually very closely divided, isn't it?
Wisconsin has a national reputation as progressive policy state, going back to the Wisconsin idea and fighting Bob La Follette, where a lot of things like, you know, public employee unions and collective bargaining sprung out of Wisconsin. I mean, the Republican Party sprung out of Wisconsin in the 1800s, opposed to slavery. You know, that came out of Wisconsin as well. Wisconsin has also produced, you know, people like McCarthy. So and Paul Ryan. You know, Russ Feingold and Paul Ryan are from the same city. That basically says it all about Wisconsin.
That was Abe Sauer, who's been covering Wisconsin politics for the website The All. That's theawl.com. theawl.com. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear about Texas. That was a bit of Space in Your Face, a new song by the Mekons from their forthcoming album, Ancient and Modern. It won't be out till September, but you can download that song, legally, at pitchfork.com. And now to Texas. Texas Governor Rick Perry, who's run that state for the last decade, longer than any of his predecessors, is teasing us with the threat of a possible presidential run. Perry, who ran Al Gore's Texas campaign in 1988, has moved steadily right over the years, especially so in the last few, where he's played to the Tea Party since its first appearance on the national scene in early 2009. Perry brags that his state produced half the jobs in this country since the end of the recession, a vastly exaggerated claim that is supposed to impress us with the charms of the Texas way, which means minimal government, a regressive tax structure that spares the rich and soaks the poor, and as little regulation of business as humanly possible. Actually, Texas has contributed about 17% of national employment growth since the job market bottomed out in February 2010. That's a lot larger than the state's 7% share of total employment, but it's also a lot less than half. And a lot of the jobs are very low wage. Texas is the highest share of workers, nearly 1 in 10, paid the minimum wage or less. That's about 60% above the national average. And that share and its lead over the national average have grown enormously over the last decade. Texas also has one of the highest poverty rates of any state, and more than 1 in 4 Texans are without health insurance, the highest share of any state. Texas, as we'll hear in a moment, is in a chronic fiscal crisis. One reason for that is that the rich are barely taxed. The poorest fifth of Texans pay about 12% of their income in taxes, 4 times the share paid by the richest 1%. Texas is a great place to be rich. If you're not rich, though, it's not so great. It's a living vision of what the right wants the entire U.S. to be. Abby Rappaport covers Texas politics for the Texas Observer, the venerable liberal weekly in that very conservative state. She's been watching Rick Perry up close. Here's what she has to say about him. Abby Rappaport. Welcome, Abby. Rick Perry may or may not be running for president, and he's getting fawning coverage on Fox News, at least from Neil Cavuto. You have a less upbeat view of your governor. He claims that he's got a great economic success story. He's been creating jobs like crazy in Texas, and we should all emulate the Texas model. What's your reaction to that claim?
I think, you know, obviously it's not disputable that, you know, in Texas has created a lot of jobs in the last, under Rick Perry's tenure. You know, a lot of people have said there are a lot of different factors that go into that, you know, and I'm no economist, so I don't want to speculate. However, at the same time that we've been doing that, Texas has also faced a huge number of kind of economic troubles in the last fiscal cycle. We just finished our session. We had a $27 billion budget shortfall, which is unprecedented, and we were constrained in how to come to solutions from that because of some dictates from the governor. Governor Perry said specifically at the beginning of the session that he would not allow lawmakers to use the $9 billion rainy day fund for the upcoming budget, the 2012-2013 budget cycle.
I'm confused by that. Isn't this the proverbial rainy day?
Well, you are not the only one who had that thought. And in fact, one of the really interesting things was that it was not just Democrats and progressives who were arguing that the Rainy Day Fund should be tapped. In fact, Republicans were also pushing for it in the state Senate. Senator Steve Ogden, who is the chief budget kind of budget writer for the Senate, head of the Finance Committee, initially proposed a budget that drew $3 billion from the Rainy Day Fund for the 2012-2013 budget cycle. And one thing to just interject here is that they did end up using $3 billion for the current budget deficit. In other words, the state was about to go broke. We had to pay our bills for the current budget year. And so Perry allowed them to use money for that, $3 billion. But that still left $6.5 billion. We still had a $23 billion amount that there was no kind of obvious solution to besides cuts. And the Senate offered a budget that included about $3 billion for the next fiscal cycle, the 2012-2013. That died kind of out of, I think many would say, out of kind of fears that the governor would veto that, you know, kind of this hardline, not using the rainy day fund approach. And so we ended up using a lot more budget tricks than we probably would have. We're deferring payments, we're speeding up collections of some things, we're raising fees, and we're cutting a huge amount. We're cutting education for the first time since we created kind of the modern system. We're cutting Medicaid and just, you know, cutting services all over the place. We're almost nowhere does the budget provide for enrollment growth, and that's one of the funny things. So all of these programs that are coming, I guess, Governor Perry has talked a lot about how fast Texas is growing and often cites those jobs as evidence of people coming in. Well, one thing that's funny is a lot of those jobs are low-wage jobs, and a lot of the people coming in on those jobs need state services. Those state services are not only getting decreased, almost none of them account for growth to enrollment. So, you know, the assumption is that the state won't grow, which is obviously not true. And so, you know, you're kind of looking at a double cut in some places.
Now, I just ran the numbers myself, and Perry made some grand claims about the share of national jobs that Texas is responsible for. I think he's claiming half of the job growth. It's actually just 17%, so he needs to have a date with the fact checker. But, you know, that is still more rapid than Texas's share of the national employment total. So if employment is growing so rapidly and the Texas model is something we should all emulate, why is the budget in such dire shape?
Well, one of the major problems we have in Texas is that our tax structure just doesn't work. And that really started in 2006. The legislature was in for a special session. People were unhappy with property taxes. Texas has very high property taxes. And so Governor Perry created a commission and created a new proposal, which created a different business tax. The old tax didn't work. It had too many loopholes. It had just been around for kind of too long and too much time for people to get involved. So ostensibly a good idea, new business tax. But the tax that he came up with was called was a tax on gross margins, which meant because it didn't tax income of a business, it taxed the kind of gross. Businesses could be losing money and still be paying the tax, which didn't make it very popular. Furthermore, it's very, very complicated. A lot of businesses had to hire people to understand just how much they owed. And then, most importantly, it simply didn't bring in the revenue that it needed. It just fell short. And in fact, something to note about that is that the Apolitical Legislative Budget Board, which does all of our economic projections for the state, projected that the tax was not going to yield enough revenue to make up for the changes. But that was kind of dismissed by proponents, including the governor of the plan. And when it implemented, sure enough, we've ended up with a $10 billion structural deficit in the state. And that structural deficit remains, you know. So I'm talking about the cuts we've made this year, but those cuts are going to, you know, most people expect them to be just, you know, to see very similar types of cuts next cycle.
Meaning that even if the economy were better, Texas would still be running a large deficit.
We have a $10 billion kind of built-in problem, yeah.
Structural hole when things even when things are going well.
Right. So even when things are going well, we have this kind of just the columns don't balance.
Now, you in this piece from the New Republic, you point out that even some Republicans and business interests are complaining about cuts to the public schools. So these are some pretty deep cuts we're talking about.
Right. And one thing to note is that initially the cuts were even worse, and those were kind of promoted. So initially we saw they expected a $10 billion cut to public schools, which is like a 20% cut, I want to say about 18%. So, you know, enormous. Through these kind of deferrals and accounting tricks, they've gotten it down to a $4 billion cut. But that's just the money that they give to public school districts to keep them running. Additionally, there's another $1 billion in cuts to, you know, programs that help school districts deal with, you know, at-risk kids, deal with grant programs for school districts trying to, you know, help different things. The Texas public school system, you know, is enormous and millions of kids. So it really impacts everyone. And I think business interests were concerned. You have Raise Your Hand Texas, which is a group that has a lot of business interests involved, and groups like that that have spoken out. I think in the piece I cited, the Texas Association of Businesses, which has been a big advocate for pre-K and all-day pre-K, kind of with the idea that, you know, a state with a dropout rate as bad as Texas is going to struggle to keep attracting good business and keep attracting kind of industries that need highly skilled, highly educated workers.
Now, when he's stepping on the toes of the Texas Association of Business, which one assumes is not the most progressive force in the world, and members of his own party, what is driving Perry in this mania for austerity?
Perry very quickly allied himself with the Tea Party movement back in 2009 and has been a big advocate of cutting spending, and that's kind of become a pretty big rallying cry in Texas. Certainly, he involved some outside groups who have been big supporters of him have also gotten involved and I think been able to advocate a similarly hardline approach that's, you know, based almost entirely on cuts. So so, you know, you had kind of a dual thing for the state legislature, where you had the governor kind of pushing it, and then you had all these outside groups that commanded quite a bit of power pushing this approach of cuts only, cuts first. One thing that's interesting is that Perry was not opposed to using the rainy day fund in previous years. In fact, the governor's enterprise fund, which is a fund that's quite controversial, that he has used in the past to lure businesses down by kind of offering them these incentives, that fund was created out of money from the rainy day fund not that long ago, you know. So it's ironic to think, you know, that we could use it then and that now we're in a different situation, but the governor, you know, obviously the politics have changed, kind of the spectrum of, you know, from right to left has changed, and so using the rainy day fund kind of became much more of a political liability.
That was Abby Rappaport, who covers politics for the Texas Observer. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from John Bakia. That was some of No Word, No Thoughts from Swans in a performance last month in Spain, broadcast by WFMU. You can get that track and another from the same performance, which ends with Michael Jira's exhortation to overthrow capitalism, of all things, at the WFMU website, wfmu.org. My next guest is John Bakia, who teaches economics at Williams College. Bakia is the lead author of a paper, along with Adam Cole and Bradley Heim, that's an investigation of that classic topic, why have the rich gotten so much richer? Their particular contribution is a careful look at the occupations of the people at the very top. Bakia also has some observations on how feasible it is to raise taxes on the rich. Their apologists always say that the rich will move away, or work less, or shelter their income somehow. Bakia's work shows that that's only true in a very limited sense. You might not be able to tax them as much as you'd like, but you can still really tax them. John Bakia. Hi, welcome. There have been a lot of explanations for what has been driving the increased concentration of income at the very top in the United States. So you've taken a novel approach to the question. Start by telling us what you did.
There's been a lot of speculation about why income inequality has been increasing so much, especially at the very top. And a lot of this speculation has occurred in the absence of having any idea of what the occupations of the people at the very top of the income distribution are, because this data is not generally publicly available. So what I did was I worked with co-authors at the Treasury Department who have access to confidential income tax return data, which I cannot see due to confidentiality reasons, but I'm able to send them programs and they can send me statistics back. And so what we did was we managed to identify what the occupations of people at the very top of the income distribution are based on what people write at the bottom of their tax return. Every year when you fill out your tax return, you write out what your occupation is. So we managed to figure that out for a variety of years since 1979. And one of the most striking things we found was that among the top 0.1% of income earners in the United States in 2004, about 41% of them called themselves executives or managers or supervisors. And then about another 18% called themselves some sort of financial professional or an executive in a financial firm. So together, that means about 60% of this really top income group, which is where the really huge income gains in recent years have been going, are basically either executives or people working in finance, which might sound obvious, but that was not well known before we did this study. So, for example, there was a paper by Kaplan and Raw that came out a few years ago in 2007 that was, prior to our study, the best evidence we had on this. And they were basically only able to identify the occupations of about 17% of the people in that top 0.1% of the income distribution based on publicly available information. And based on their data, it suggested only 4% of this group were non-financial executives of publicly traded firms. Now, the difference is their data on executives was just based on publicly available information on the top 5 paid executives at publicly traded firms, so firms that are bought and sold on the stock market. But they're leaving out a lot of other executives who might not be in the top 5, as well as lots of executives who work for privately held companies that are not bought and sold on the stock market. And when you throw all those people in there, it's more like 41%. And, you know, one interesting thing about this finding is it suggests that what's going on in executive compensation and what's going on in finance must play a really important role in explaining why inequality has been increasing so much.
Now, I think a lot of people have no sense of what goes on at the top 0.1%. So what kind of income level are we talking about? What's happened to those folks over the last 20 or 30 years?
Yeah, so to qualify for the top 0.1% of the income distribution in recent years, you need about $1.7 million of income, including capital gains, or about $1.3 million if you leave out capital gains, which tend to fluctuate a lot for reasons besides, you know, for obvious reasons like the stock market. So you need to be pretty rich. And their incomes have been going up quite a bit over time, and this is one of the most striking phenomena in our economy. So if you look at the top 0.1% and include capital gains in income, between 1979 and 2008, the share of our nation's income going to this group, the top 0.1%, went from about 3.4% to, in 2008, the latest year for which we have data, 10.4%. And that 10.4% is down a little bit from its peak of around over 12% since the financial crisis, but it's still, you know, a lot bigger than it used to be. And if you look at the top 1%, that number has increased from about 10% to about 21% today.
And what does it take to get into the top 1%?
If you exclude capital gains, the threshold there is quite a bit lower. It's about $300,000. If you include capital gains, it's a bit higher than that.
How important are capital gains to people at that income level?
They're pretty important, but, you know, so my rough recollection is it's, you know, it could be somewhere around 30% of income or something like this on average. But what the research shows, and a lot of this research has been done by Emmanuel Sayaz and Thomas Piketty, what the research shows is that a really large portion of the increase in incomes for these top groups is coming from wages and salaries and business income. So, like, for example, income you get from owning your own business or a partnership or something like this. So a lot of the growth in incomes really comes from that, right? Like, we've gone away from having a rentier society and much more towards a society where the top of the income distribution is people who are earning money from a job or a business. You know, I should also mention that when an executive gets paid in stock options on your tax return, that counts as wage and salary income, generally speaking. So a lot of the action that's showing up on tax returns in terms of the increases in income for the top is showing up as wage and salary income. But for executives, a lot of that wage and salary income is actually, you know, stock options.
Now, we had a very strong stock market in the 80s and 90s, not so much in the 2000s so far. But how much did that contribute to the concentration of income at the top?
Well, I think that's a very important part of the explanation. You know, I mean, ever since, you know, the stock market is still way up relative to where it was in 1979. And, you know, our research is suggesting that this is more important than was previously appreciated. Since, you know, about 60% of this top group is either executives or finance people, their pay is very closely tied to what's going on in the stock market. And if you look at how their incomes have, you know, varied over time, it matches what's happening in the stock market pretty closely. Not surprisingly, right? I mean, they're getting a lot of their pay as stock options, or finance people's pay is going to be tied to how financial markets are doing. So I think an important part of the explanation for why inequality has increased so much at the top is, you know, a lot of the people who constitute this top group have pay that just happens to be tied to what's going on in financial markets.
And in a way, they've been lucky, you know, because the financial markets boomed and their stock options turned out to be worth a lot more than anybody could have anticipated. And the recent, you know, the recent declines in the stock market temper that to some extent, but there's, you know, it's still way higher than it used to be. So their share of income is still way higher. Now, by no means is this the only explanation for the rising income inequality, but our study suggests that this is a more important part of the explanation than was previously appreciated.
And I know you're focusing mostly on U.S. data, but you have reviewed the literature on what happened abroad. And how does what happened in the United States compare to what happened in other rich areas, particularly Japan and Western Europe?
Yeah, so that's really interesting as well. This, again, is people like Emmanuel Saez at Berkeley and Thomas Piketty, who's an economist in France, and Tony Atkinson in the U.K. have been doing research on this. And they've been, you know, they've put together information like this for a huge number of countries now. And what we're finding essentially is that this huge surge in top incomes is pretty much isolated to English-speaking countries. No country has quite as pronounced an increase in top income shares as the U.S., but other English-speaking countries have similar, you know, they also have big increases, not nearly as big as the U.S., but like Canada, the U.K., Australia, New Zealand, all these countries have increases in the share of income going to the top 1% and the top 0.1%. In continental Europe and Japan, it's been pretty flat. I mean, there's been a little bit of an uptick in recent years in continental Europe, but not much. And I think that's important for thinking through what could explain the rising income inequality in the U.S. Some of the leading explanations that are out there have to do with the effects of technology, the effects of globalization. These things might, you know, favor highly skilled people and so forth. But you would presume that, you know, technology and globalization ought to be increasing the incomes of people at the top of the distribution in Japan and continental Europe, if those are really good explanations. Now, that's not dispositive, because it could be maybe the way technology and globalization is working is that people in the English-speaking countries are now taking over markets that used to demand this, you know, highly skilled people in continental Europe and Japan. So maybe U.S. pop stars are now dominating the world, although they're a fairly small share of this top group. So that's interesting. The other interesting thing the international data points out is one possible explanation for the rising in top income shares in the U.S. is that it might be a response to improved incentives among the rich. So we've cut tax rates on very high-income people, and some people argue, well, that would create an incentive to work harder and to take more risk, to become an entrepreneur, all this kind of thing. So some people argue that this is part of what's going on. But we see a lot of other countries, particularly Japan, where they've had similarly large cuts in tax rates on very high-income people, and we see no increase in the incomes earned by the rich in those countries. So now it could be maybe people in the rich in the U.S. are more responsive to incentives than people in Japan, but it might also suggest that there's something else going on besides taxes that's driving this. So it could be social norms in the U.S. that are allowing executive compensation to increase a lot more than they do in Japan.
Well, also, the English-speaking countries tend to have a larger role for the stock market in both in economy and corporate governance, and more loosely regulated financial systems in general. Is that would that suggest that that's really where the action is, and not all the other explanations?
Well, I think that I think the international evidence suggests that has something to do with it. So, for example, until recently in Japan, it was illegal to pay executives with stock options. So, you know, that strength, you know, the fact that top incomes didn't go up in Japan and they went way up in the U.S., you know, that supports the idea that maybe these stock options are a really important part of the explanation. You know, in addition, you know, the norms are different. So, for example, in France, they do pay executives with stock options, but the norms are such that executive pay is just much lower than in the U.S. And, you know, it's hard to we don't have a good measure of social norms, but you know, anecdotally, it seems like people in continental Europe pay a lot more attention to executive compensation, and, you know, like unions are out in the street demonstrating if executive pay gets too high. So that, you know, that could be part of the explanation.
I'm speaking with John Bakia, who is a professor of economics at Williams College in Massachusetts. Another popular explanation of the rise of income to the very top has been a kind of superstar explanation. And it's just not just superstar CEOs and financial managers, but athletes and movie stars and pop stars. You alluded to this, but how big a role does that play?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, my view is that that does play an important role, but it's just one among many of these things that we've been talking about. So, for example, people in art, media, and sports represent about 3% of this top group, you know, and they are the ones where the superstar theory seems to make the most sense. But, I mean, the superstar theory could apply more broadly to other professions, too. Like, if you're the best business consultant in the world, now, because of technology, you can sell your skills to a global market instead of just in your local market, and that could lead to your income going way up. So it might apply more broadly to lots of different professions. And we can see, you know, there's some evidence in the data supporting the superstar theory. So we can see, for example, you know, we calculated between 1979 and 2005 what the, you know, which professions who are in the very top of the income distribution, which had the fastest income growth. And, you know, some of the groups at the top were people in finance, not surprisingly, and real estate as well. I mean, our data ended at the end of the real estate bubble. But right also near the top in terms of rate of income growth were people in art, media, and sports, and also business operations, which is mostly consultants. So those two groups, the superstar theory could well apply. You know, now it could be the superstar theory applies to executives too. I mean, you know, now if you're the best executive in the world, you can manage a much bigger company. So there's something to that as well. With that said, it's, you know, for this to be an important part of the explanation, you also need to explain why superstars in continental Europe and Japan are not seeing an enormous increase in their incomes. You know, again, it could be maybe the superstars from the English-speaking world are displacing demand for the superstars in these other countries. That's at least possible, but we don't have really good data on that.
We also might need to explain why there are more superstars now than there were 30 years ago. It's not, has the distribution of talent changed, or the reward of talent has changed?
Yeah, well, I mean, what our data is suggesting is not so much that there are more superstars, it's just whatever the given superstars are, their income is skyrocketing, right? I mean, in a way, the increase in inequality is sometimes called fractal in nature. Like, the thinner you slice the income distribution towards the top, the faster the income growth is, right? So the higher up you go in the distribution, the faster the growth is. So if you look, you know, the growth in the top 0.1% in income is much faster over time than the growth for the rest of the top 1%. And the growth in the top 0.001% is even faster than the growth in the top 0.1%. So the higher you go, the faster the income growth is, which is also consistent with the superstar idea. Although, you know, it's also consistent with these other things like stories about executive compensation and stock options and things like that, because, you know, the really big stock options tend to be concentrated among the really top executives of the really big firms.
Just a parenthetical question, and you may not have addressed this, but how are people, private equity titans, like, you know, Steve Schwarzman, for example, are they counted as financial executives? Because in the flow of funds accounts, the Fed counts them as non-financial, so I'm curious about the income they would count, in the income statistics, they would count as financial professionals.
Yeah, so we're counting them as financial professionals. So we made the financial professional net as wide as we possibly could. So anybody who either, you know, so basically we took anybody who named their profession as having anything to do with finance at all, we put them in the financial group, and also anybody who is an executive or manager who reported working for a firm that was in the financial industry, we counted them too. And those all together make up about 18% of this top 0.1% of income earners. So like the private equity and hedge fund guys, you know, to a very large extent are going to be in this category, unless we somehow miss them because they said they were doing something else than they were actually doing.
Or their money is hidden in Bermuda.
Yeah.
You also, your work also sheds light on the question of taxation and tax policy with the federal budget deficit on everyone's mind. There's been some talk of raising taxes on the rich, or at least just letting the Bush tax cuts expire. you know, of course, that always meets the objection that if you raise taxes on the rich, that will only depress their incomes and you'll end up collecting less than you did before. But what does your work tell you about that argument?
Well, I guess what I would say is that my work points out reasons to be not very confident about our, you know, about the evidence on whether raising tax rates actually causes the rich to earn less income. You know, there's been a lot of research on this question, but it's just really hard to distinguish empirically the causal effect of cutting marginal tax rates on the incomes of the rich from all these other things that are changing over time, like technology and globalization and social norms that affect executive compensation and all these other things. And a lot of these other factors we don't have good measures for, like social norms, for example. So I think what, you know, there's, you know, you'll read editorials in the Wall Street Journal saying, oh, we're very confident that the evidence shows that, you know, if we raise tax rates, the rich are going to work much less. But I think really we can't be confident in that at all. Because there's so many other explanations, and a lot of what our data is showing is that, you know, these other explanations seem pretty important. For example, you know, the fact that so much of this top group is executives and finance people, and their pay, the fact that their pay mirrors what's going on in the stock market so closely suggests that alternative explanation must explain a lot of what why incomes went up so much for the rich. And that suggests it's definitely not all about, you know, better responses to incentives because we cut marginal tax rates. So I guess what I would say is our research, I think, if anything, would tend to suggest that, you know, it strengthens the alternative arguments besides taxes for why incomes have been going up so much for the rich. But again, I would also caution that, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty about this because we don't have a really good controlled experiment on this. You know, I mean, the best we have is we can compare what's happening to the rich compared to the middle class when the rich get a tax cut and the others don't. And that's not very convincing evidence because, again, so many other things are changing over time for the rich. We can compare across countries, and the evidence there is pretty mixed, as I mentioned before. So, for example, we cut tax rates a lot in Japan. Why didn't income go up there? So I guess I would say, you know, the evidence on whether the rich are really responding to tax rates is pretty uncertain.
Now, what about the not quite so rich, the people below the top 1/10 or 1%?
Well, so there, I think the evidence is even weaker of people responding to marginal tax rates. I mean, when we did our statistical analysis, you know, if you lump everybody together, like rich and non-rich, and look at, you know, try to estimate whether people earn more income when you cut their marginal tax rates and try as best we can to control for other things that might affect their incomes, you essentially find no effect of tax rates on income. You know, the only way we were able to get estimates of a responsiveness of income to tax rates is if we just focused on this top 0.1% group. And there, you know, under certain ways of doing the statistical analysis, you find evidence that, you know, the rich earn more income if you cut their marginal tax rates, but that evidence is not very, it's rather fragile, right? Like if you do a better job of controlling for alternative explanations, then it becomes very uncertain again. So I guess what I'd say is, you know, I don't want to claim that there's no response to improved incentives when we cut marginal tax rates for the rich. I would just say that the degree of uncertainty about this is bigger than is commonly claimed by people in the political, people who have a political agenda.
And also with states facing their own fiscal crises, there's obviously some temptation to raise taxes on the rich within those states. You did some work, now it's a few years old, but it might shed some light on that question. Does your research show that people are likely to up and move if a state raises taxes on the upper brackets?
Yeah, so what this other research did was we looked at where people lived when they died and filed federal estate tax returns. So only very rich people pay the federal estate tax. I think, you know, currently it's above like $2 million or something like that of wealth. When you die, will you pay the federal estate tax? So we're looking at basically the super rich, okay? And we had data going back to the early 1960s, and over this time period, tax rates on the rich, both income tax rates and estate and inheritance tax rates, change in very different ways over time in different states. So what we did was we looked at, you know, if your state had a reduction in taxes on the rich, did you end up seeing more rich people die there afterwards compared to other states that didn't have such a change in tax policy? So we had a nice treatment and control group. And what we found was, indeed, it looked like the rich were moving out of states that had higher taxes on the rich, or at least pretending to move. Like, you know, it's hard to pretend to move, but you can buy a house in another state, and, you know, if you have a good lawyer, maybe you can convince the tax authorities that you live there for most of the year, and that's your primary residence. But so either, you know, we did find evidence that people were either moving or pretending to move, because we saw less estate tax returns filed in the states where the taxes on the rich were higher. However, we also found, you know, so the evidence was we had a pretty precisely estimated response to these taxes on the rich, but it was also pretty small. Okay, so for example, we were finding something like if you increase the inheritance tax by 1 percentage point, you end up with something like 2% to 3% fewer very rich people living in the state, which is, you know, nothing to sneeze at, but it still suggests that, you know, these taxes on the rich are, you know, still raising a lot of revenue for the state. You know, they're losing some rich people, but they're not losing so many that the taxes on the rich are pointless. They're still going to get, most of the revenue they would have got anyway. They lose a little bit of it because some of the tax base moves out.
So if the state crafts it carefully and isn't too aggressive, they're going to end up considerably ahead.
Well, they'll get more revenue, yeah. But, I mean, you know, there is a cost to driving some people, rich people, out of the state. It's just that the cost is not so great that it's pointless, right? I mean, there's a trade-off here. You know, there's some economic harm caused by making your rich people leave the state. But you need to weigh that against the benefits of the revenue that you'll get from taxing them.
That was John Bakia, a professor of economics at Williams College in Massachusetts. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I've been worrying lately that I'm getting too mellow musically, so here's a bracing antidote to that fear, a song by The Men, as their record label, Sacred Bone, says, yes, The Men, a post-punk quartet from Brooklyn. This is a bit of Think from their album, Leave Home. Till next week, bye.